already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
From WPFW News in Washington, this is Monday Morning QB, a news program with a point of view. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2024. I'm Sue Goodwin.
And I'm Chris Spangert-Drowns. Today on the show, the latest in the madness to control what we read and why it's not just about books.
I've learned this concept recently of moral injury, moral harm, when one has to, due to constraints outside of one's control, violate the values that we hold most dear. And I think there are a lot of librarians across the country right now facing exactly that.
Plus, local budget cuts could mean disaster for teachers and students in Washington, D.C.
All that and more. Stay with us. Washington, D.C. is facing a budget crunch. Between the lingering effects of pandemic-era commercial property disuse, the projected budget shortfall of transit provider WMATA, and a requirement from the district's chief financial officer that a rainy day fund be fully replenished, the district's public funding is under strain. In reaction to these fiscal pressures, Mayor Muriel Bowser proposed a budget seeking deep cuts in the district's education and other social spending. Particularly, Bowser's proposed budget eliminates a program to boost pay for early childhood educators and makes cuts to a new baby bonds program as well as the district's earned income tax credit. New polling from the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute suggests these policies run counter to the desires of district residents, who overwhelmingly support alternative methods to balancing the budget, including by establishing a business activity tax and higher taxes on wealthy households. D.C. FPI Executive Director Erica Williams joined Monday Morning QB to explain the Bowser budget and why it could be deeply harmful. Williams began by talking about how Bowser's proposed increase in the sales tax contributes to deepening inequity in the district.
You know, sales taxes are regressive, and what that means for folks who are listening is that it asks more as a share of income from folks with lower incomes and moderate incomes than it does from folks with higher incomes. So unlike our income tax system, which is based on the ability to pay, the sales tax is not. It is a flat rate on goods and services, and people pay that same amount, no matter if their incomes are low or high. And what it means for folks with low incomes is that it eats up a bigger share of what they have to spend. That's a really big deal for folks with low and moderate incomes who spend nearly every dollar they earn, if not every dollar or more than what they earn, to make ends meet, right? To pay rent, to put food on the table, to keep their kids clothed and all of those things. And so it is harmful to have a sales tax increase in this budget, both because it makes us more reliant on a regressive source of funding that is hitting low-income households hardest, and also because it is paired in this budget with a whole bunch of cuts that hit the same exact communities, folks who are struggling to get by on low incomes, who in the district, because of historic and structural racism, you know, are disproportionately Black and brown folks.
Another of Mayor Bowser's proposals is the elimination of the Early Childhood Educator Pay Equity Fund. And I think it's important to emphasize that this is a proposed pay cut, not a pay freeze, and a substantial one at that, too. The Washington Post reports that some educators could see their incomes drop by as much as 40%. What are the implications of this cut, not only for teachers themselves, but for the general effort to strengthen early education in DC?
Yeah, the implications are huge. They are huge. We adopted in 2018 the Birth to Three law, which said we're going to guarantee equity for every child at birth, which meant that for our kids who are 0 to 3, we wanted to make sure that they were in the highest quality environments possible. And as part of the Birth to Three law, we also envisioned as a district that we want to get to a place where quality childcare is also affordable, and so that no family is paying more than 7% of its income on childcare. We have some of the most expensive childcare in the country here in the district, and it's a big deal for families going even much farther up the income spectrum than people might imagine. So it's a big deal. This law was a bigger vision for how we get to really high quality early learning and care opportunities for our youngest children, how we get to affordable care for our working families, and how we, you know, really create a childcare sector that is top notch and that all families have access to if they need it and want it. And it's a beautiful vision, and I think one that really would pay off in big ways for our economy, for our local economy. You know, 2 years ago, we raised revenue by a modest increase in our income taxes for those with incomes above $250,000 to help us pay for this first step in implementing the Birth to Three vision. So we wanted to make sure that we were paying our early educators in the childcare sector what they should be paid for the kinds of credentials we want them to have. So we're creating a pay parity structure with our public pre-K teachers, saying, like, if you have a bachelor's degree and, you know, a certain set of credentials, that you're going to be paid what we've deemed that's worth, or that should be valued within our public pre-K system. And this law, or this part of the law, this expansion through the Pay Equity Fund has been implemented. So there are all these early educators in our childcare sector who've been able to see their wages grow because of this, that are finally getting paid according to their education and credentialing in ways that they have long deserved. And you also see all of these early educators in the childcare sector going out and getting additional credentials to, you know, build their skill in ways that can raise their wages over time as well. And we're now basically ripping the rug right out from under that. We're saying, nope, just kidding. We raised your wages. And for a lot of folks, we gave you access to healthcare for the first time through DC's exchange. And we're reneging on that. We're pulling back on that commitment to you. That's what this budget proposes to do. And it is highly problematic for the workers themselves, 4,000 mostly Black and brown women caring for our very youngest children. It's problematic for the childcare facilities that are going to have to scramble to figure out what to do, either cut pay or make childcare more expensive. Is problematic for the families that are going to have to pay higher fees for the childcare they're receiving, or potentially not have access to the same facilities if there are fewer workers willing to do the work for the lower pay. And, you know, I think that is really going to undermine our economy. We know that when childcare is unavailable, that fewer women end up going to work because of the gender roles that continue to persist in our country and in this city, and we will see the impact of that. So this is a massive blow to the childcare sector. This is a first of its kind of program that is, as I don't know if you saw, but Councilmember Henderson said so passionately during the budget briefing with the mayor the other day, that is the envy of the nation. I mean, folks are looking at DC and how we're on the front lines of transformative change. And this is something that the mayor has just zeroed out in her budget proposal.
You've been on the program twice before to discuss the work of the DC Tax Revision Commission, which is this group that's convened every 10 years to discuss DC tax policy and propose some revisions to it. Can you provide an update on the commission's work and talk generally about alternative ways for the district to use tax policy to address its current budget deficit?
Yeah, the Tax Revision Commission, unfortunately, has had a bit of a hiccup, if I can use a euphemistic term, for a little bit of a disruption and blow up of our process. We had intended to have a package of proposals ready for the council and the mayor to review before the budget season began. So we should have had recommendations to them, frankly, last fall, but, you know, also earlier this year would have potentially helped the mayor to shape her budget proposal and helped prepare council to think about tax policy in this year's budget. We weren't able to do that. We had a package of proposals that included a handful of bigger revenue raisers and some investments in families and communities through the tax code, as well as some tax changes for businesses. The package was revenue neutral and seemed to have consensus support or near consensus support within the commission, but then sort of fell apart at the end. And I think with a lot of focus and a lot of fear around downtown. And, you know, this is, I think, a common theme happening right now, that downtown is sort of sucking all of the oxygen out of the room and keeping us from thinking longer term and bigger picture about what the district needs. I think the Tax Commission has done a lot of good research, has great staff that have done a lot of good research on different tax policy ideas that could really help the district think about how to broaden its tax base, how to make its revenue system more resilient over time, which was a key goal, and how to make our tax code more equitable as well. And there are good ideas in the draft package and even good ideas that didn't make it into the draft package that I hope lawmakers will still take a look at. You know, I hope that council will look at those ideas and see them as potential solutions to some of the budget pressures we're facing right now, and not be shy about going ahead and using those ideas, because, you know, sometimes a process gets blown up and you don't get to the finish line, or you don't get to the finish line in time. That doesn't mean the ideas that got developed aren't worth evaluating. So I do hope lawmakers will do that. I hope the public will take a look at what was done and, you know, make their case for where they'd like to see things go. But I think the Tax Commission itself will probably try again to finalize a draft package this summer for submission to the council and the mayor in the fall. If we get across the finish line, that package would be there for review by lawmakers in the fall and for the next budget season. But that doesn't keep us from having the job in front of us right now, doesn't keep lawmakers from having to make really important decisions right now about how to resource the array of critical needs that have been left unaddressed or that have been sort of slashed in this year's budget proposal. So I do think there are good ideas on the table that folks can look to raise the resources we need and to have less drastic choices being made in the FY 2025 budget.
We've discussed a lot here, but I wanted to give you a chance to provide closing thoughts if you have any.
My big takeaway from this budget and the proposal on the table is that despite the fact that it's being called a shared sacrifice, a budget of shared sacrifice and strategic investments, I think that the sacrifices being made are not at all shared, that they very much fall on low-income communities and families who, like I said, because of systemic racism in our history, are disproportionately Black and Brown families and communities, and that the strategic investments are actually quite short-sighted. It's very much about what to do about downtown right now, when we really should be thinking about what is the district that we want to live in? What is our vision for that? And how do we get there? And how do we bring all of our families and communities along? How do we ensure that every community across the district is able to live to their fullest and contribute to their fullest? That is going to strengthen our revenue system and our economy. What are the revenue streams we need to develop to make sure we have resilience and stability in the future, knowing that we may not get back to the place that we were with commercial property tax revenue? How are we adapting to our new context and making sure that our economy is strong and working for everyone? So I think that we have, with every budget, an opportunity to pursue a vision of a more equitable, inclusive district, and that we shouldn't take for granted any of those opportunities, and that we should be making sure that when we have tough choices to make, that we are not putting the burden on folks who have the least to give and to contribute. And so, you know, I really hope that folks will dig deep this year and find ways to raise revenue by asking those of us who are doing really well here in the district to contribute more, so that we don't have to undermine families and communities that have long been struggling to get by.
That's Erica Williams, Executive Director of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute. Learn more about the Institute and its work by visiting dcfpi.org. That's dcfpi.org. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio has wrapped up an eventful 7-day visit to the United States. President Biden and the Prime Minister of Japan agree to deepen defense cooperation and strengthen collaboration in a wide range of areas such as economic security and space. Kishida was the first Japanese Prime Minister in 9 years to receive hospitality normally reserved for state guests. Japan is a close ally and key component of the U.S. strategy towards China, North Korea, and other Asian security issues. There are over 50,000 U.S. military personnel based in Japan, the highest number stationed anywhere overseas. In addition to the Japanese leader's visit to Washington, Philippine President Marcos Jr. joined the meeting with the two Asian leaders to attend a trilateral summit on maritime security in the Pacific region. To learn more, I spoke with a Washington correspondent who's been following the state visit step by step.
Hi, I am Ken Moriyasu. I'm the Washington correspondent for Nikkei Asia. Nikkei Asia is the English language arm of Nikkei newspaper, Japan's largest financial newspaper. And I've been in Washington for 6 months now.
President Biden and Japan's Prime Minister Kishida discussed as many as 70 cooperation agreements during the state visit. One senior White House official said this was the largest set of substantial, significant deliverables we've seen to date. What were the top issues on the agenda?
Yes, I think the top issue from the Japanese side was to show not only the White House, but the Congress and also the people of America how Japan is crucial to Japan, to America's strategy in the Indo-Pacific. And especially as the American side describes China as the number one threat, the pacing threat, as they use it, to show the Americans that Japan geographically and the fact that they have 55,000 American troops on Japanese soil, that it's very crucial for America going forward. And this is not only to strengthen ties with the Biden administration, but it's also a message to the Trump camp, in the case that Trump does win a second term, that Japan would be crucial and that there was no need to change the relationship whatsoever. And the 70 so-called deliverables, or the agreements that came up in the summit, usually they say the deliverables are like 12 to 20, but they made an effort to list up 70 agreements just to show how aligned these countries' strategies are.
Beijing has repeatedly accused Washington of Cold War thinking that has ratcheted up tensions. Can you share more on China's position and the use of the language Cold War thinking?
Yes, this is a fundamental difference between America and China in the relationship going forward. I think the American side sees China as a potential threat. And it sees that probably the next potential war with China, if there were to ever to be a war with China, if the two economies and two technologies are too integrated, that would directly affect the outcome of the war. So to give an example, past wars like the Iraq War in 2003 began by lots of heavy bombing. It was called shock and awe. And America beat Iraq with overwhelming force. But that's not the war America envisions with China. They think it's going to be a very quiet war, and it'll be decided in the opening 10 minutes. That's because it's going to be a cyber war, and it's going to be an electronic war. And if China manages to take down the GPS satellite from the American side, for instance, that would immediately remove all the advantages, the military advantages America has. So to prevent that, the American side thinks that it has to remove all Chinese gadgets from its infrastructure, and it's asking Japan and its allies to do the same. So that is the decoupled future America envisions. And Biden has told Xi Jinping in his meeting in San Francisco last November that they want a competitive cooperation in some areas, but mainly healthy competition between the two countries, and basically a decoupling on the high-tech side. Xi Jinping, the Chinese side, disagrees with this future. They say that it should be a win-win, and that any technological advances on both sides should be celebrated, and that they could compete, but there should not be any decoupling. So there's a fundamental difference there. And that is related to the, although both sides don't say it out loud, what is in their minds is the next war and how that war would look like.
The Pentagon annual report on China says the People's Liberation Army, Navy, has around 355 ships and submarines, which makes it among the world's largest. How does that compare to the U.S. and its allies?
Yes. So it is already the world's number one army. America only has like 298 ships right now, so it has overtaken. But what's more scary for the American side, that the gap is only going to increase. That's because China has a huge industrial base, many shipyards that are churning out ships at an astonishing pace. On the American side, this is not the case, because in the late 1990s, after the Cold War ended, there was this hope, especially in the Clinton administration, that now that the Cold War has ended, there should be a peace dividend, and that we can reduce our defense budget and use it for social security and education and all those domestic issues. And as a result of that, America used to have 13 public naval shipyards, 9 of them closed, and there's only 4 now. And so naturally, America just cannot produce the number of ships like it used to, and it cannot maintain the number of ships that, like it used to. So the gap between China and America is only going to increase. One of the topics of this last week's summit was to use Japanese shipyards first for maintenance of American ships, but they are envisioning possibly producing American warships in Japanese shipyards. That's how desperate the American side is.
Biden has discussed bolstering military defenses in the Indo-Pacific region directly with the Australian, Indian, Philippines, and Japanese leaders. What can be anticipated in the next decade or two? And will the alliance be strong enough to cause China to back down?
Right. So this all depends on the Chinese leader. The Japanese side, for instance, has watched Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, for 12 years now. And they've, I think, come to a conclusion that the way Xi Jinping sees the world is just not compatible with the way Japan wants to maintain its way of life. And when I say that, that means like in the past years, in Hu Jintao, Jiang Zemin's era, and Deng Xiaoping's era, there was at least an effort or a perceived effort on the Chinese side to make reforms so that it would adjust to the international system. It joined the WTO. It wanted to be a major player with responsibilities on the global stage. Xi Jinping is a little different because he wants the international order to accept China. He wants to change the order. He wants to create a new order that is more acceptable of Chinese, the Chinese Communist Party rule. And that doesn't require painful reforms on its side. It doesn't have to be democratic. It doesn't have to reduce the state subsidies to state-owned enterprises. He thinks that China is big, therefore the world has to adjust to it. Now, this path is not compatible to Japan, and it's not compatible to the Philippines or Australia or India. So as long as that kind of mentality continues, I think, to answer your question, I think these countries will align with the U.S. and find ways to deter China from taking Taiwan, for instance, by sheer military might. But if China does change and go back to a leader, an ex-leader, who is more willing to reform and at least on the surface trying to be polite and trying to be friendly with his neighbors, I think that would create cracks in the alliance, on the Western alliance, and then that would be a that would help China much better, I think. But under Xi Jinping, that's not happening.
In 2022, there was speculation that China would invade Taiwan during the U.S. presidential election, especially leading up to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Is the U.S. hosting this state visit with the Japanese leader to also warn China to not annex Taiwan?
No, I don't think China is preparing to invade Taiwan just because the costs are too high. It has seen Russia being significantly weakened and ostracized in the international community. And Russia is able to survive because it has natural gas exports, which it's selling to India and China. But China doesn't have that. China's economy is premised on the fact that it has good relations with the world and it exports and people buy Chinese goods. So if China is isolated or ostracized in the international community, it won't be in as good a position as Russia is now. And just for that reason, I don't think China is will do that. And right now it's militarily not ready to take on the U.S. If such a day comes, China, Xi Jinping, the leader, has to have 100% confidence that it's going to work. And right now, I don't think he has that confidence, just because America has gone through 2.5 decades of war in Iraq, Afghanistan, all over the place. China hasn't fought a single war during that period. And there's so much uncertainty and there's so much risk, because if he does start a war and he doesn't win, that's the end of the Communist Party rule. So I think the risk is just too high at this stage.
Anything else, Ken, to add that I may not have asked?
Yeah. One of the things that I think was important about this Kishida visit to Washington last week is that it might be remembered in history as a time when Japan became the most important ally for the U.S. overtaking the U.K. And that's due to geography and to history. Geography, because America's number one threat is China, and Japan happens to be right next to China. So that's an unmistaken fact. The second, when I say history, when you look at where the American base troops are based, it's number one, Japan, number two, Germany, number three, South Korea, number four, Italy. That's where American overseas bases are. Condense that. And those places are where the Americans were involved in a war. World War II, Japan Germany, Italy, when America won, they went in and confiscated the military bases. In the case of South Korea, the Americans were there to help the South Korea in the Korean War. So due to those historic reasons, America is able to maintain these forces. And those forces, the 55,000 troops in Japan, have never been more important to Japan or to America. And I think for that reason, Japan is now more crucial than the UK to America's strategy.
That's Ken Mariasu, Nikkei Asia's Washington correspondent, on the Japanese Prime Minister's state visit to the U.S., bolstering military defense in the Indo-Pacific region.
For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin. The American Library Association last week released its annual State of America's Libraries Report, and what is also an annual tradition, released its list of the top 10 most challenged books of the previous year. Gender Queer by Maya Kobabe was the most challenged book in America in 2023, for the third year in a row, in a list that has All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson in second place, and This Book is Gay by Juno Dawson in third place. As the Library Association defines it, a book challenge is an attempt to remove or restrict a book from libraries or school curricula based on the objections of a person or group. And as their report reveals, more than 4,000 book titles were threatened last year in public libraries, schools, and universities across the country. That's the largest number challenged since the ALA began recording censorship data about 20 years ago. So, to put this number in a larger context, we reached out to Emily Drabinski, president of the American Library Association.
2023 saw a 65% increase in the number of individual unique book titles that were targeted for censorship. So we're up to 4,240 books. And I think it's important to remember that each of those books represents an author, a reader, and the librarian whose job it is to connect the two. So that's a lot of stories that are not being heard. I wake up every morning hoping that this is over, but we're seeing an acceleration in public libraries, an ongoing increase in challenges in school libraries, and so we're definitely not out of the woods yet.
As to where this is happening, while it is true that Florida and Texas lead the country on book bans, incidents of censorship have been recorded in 41 states. 17 states reported threats on more than 100 titles, including Connecticut, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as it's sort of like wildfires. They pop up all over. I was talking to a librarian in New Jersey who was saying that she was not seeing any talk of organized attempts to challenge books in her community, but 10 minutes away by car, the community was sort of on fire with challenges. And so it really is everywhere.
And in some states, it goes beyond challenges to specific books, but actual legislation that defines how librarians can be held accountable if they continue to distribute materials that have been successfully challenged.
I think we are seeing adverse legislation in some states and not others. I come from the great state of Idaho, grew up there. I spent my whole life as a young queer person in Idaho, and that state just this week had a new law signed by the governor that would criminalize librarians for circulating materials that people deem harmful to minors and require librarians to pay a fine of $250 if they refuse to move books out of the youth services section of a library. And to me, this is an assault not only on the right to read certain ideas, and to hear certain kinds of stories from certain experiences, but also a systematic attempt to undermine the agency and authority of public sector library workers who know their communities and know the books they want to read. So at that, that kind of state legislation we're seeing in some states and not others.
And it's not just the number of books being challenged and the potential targeting of librarians that is causing alarm. There are also some clear themes that emerge in the counting of challenges that target very specific groups of people, which means that when these challenges actually turn into book bans and books are taken off the shelves, this could exacerbate feelings of isolation and discrimination.
It's very clear that books are targeted for content that is related to LGBTQ plus experience, the lives and experiences of Black people, of people of color. Any books that tell the difficult history of this country, particularly stories of racial harm, those are the kinds of stories that are being targeted for erasure. And as a queer person myself, I think it's also important to remember that attempts to censor these books are also attempts to censor these people. When I think about a young person growing up in Idaho like I did, wondering who they might be and what their desire might mean about who they are and feeling completely alone in that, making sure that kids like me growing up now today have access to books that can help them understand themselves and the world of which they're a part. Those are the books that are being challenged. The experience of feeling yourself to be less alone, that is sort of the experience that's being targeted as well.
As to the how of what goes into challenging a book, it is not uncommon to see as a given reason to suggest banning a book that it contains sexually explicit material, which, as Emily Drabinsky explains, couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, I mean, it just bears no relation to what is actually happening. Libraries don't collect sexually explicit materials, and we certainly don't collect sexually explicit materials for children or youth. The books that are being targeted are, you know, there are people who exist in the world who are lesbian or gay, and those experiences are represented in the book, but there's nothing that's sexually explicit about being those things, about occupying those identities, and it's just, yeah, it's been mystifying. One of the categories of books that I see being challenged are books that explain puberty to young people. You know, we're seeing pushes to move those books about puberty to the adult section of the library. And I just, you know, it's so clear to me who the audience is for those books. Like, if you've gone through puberty, you hopefully have fewer questions about it. So libraries collect those materials because they see a need in their communities for them. And I just wish that we could be trusted as the professionals we are to make those decisions on behalf of people who might not be you or might not share your values, but are people who nonetheless deserve access to information.
So what about the why now of so many challenges to books? As Emily Drabinsky reminds us, this is hardly the first time that attacks on books and information were part of a larger political project.
Right. I think of, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, it was rap music and video games. Books came under assault during the McCarthy era. There's a great film called Storm Center starring Betty Davis that came out in 1956 that has a sort of prescient story, I think, in it, where a small town librarian refuses to remove a book about communism from her small town library and then becomes targeted for a hate campaign, and the library is put at great risk. And so we know that this happens at different moments in history. I think about the denial of access to libraries in the segregated South to Black Americans. So this is part of a long struggle in this country over who has access to the public good, who has access to public institutions, and whether or not the state has an obligation to facilitate human flourishing or not, right? And so it's a fight over what kind of country we want to live in.
And even in the context of history, this moment does stand out. And what that means is that in more ways than one, librarians are paying the price. Huffington Post recently reported that some librarians are quitting their jobs because of constant harassment. Others are getting fired for refusing to clear shelves of books that conservatives don't like. Speaking to Huffington Post, Emily Drabinsky had a name for it, She calls it the weaponization of libraries. And she explained to us what that means.
It means that in some communities in this country right now, you have people attacking the library as a way of attacking the very fabric of our communities. So if we think of the library as an institution that knits people together, that circulates public goods to the public, that ensures that everyone is heard and has a place in a community, no matter who they are, regardless of means and identity, that when you attack the library, that's what you're attacking. You're attacking the work that libraries do to knit together the social fabric. And for anyone who uses a library or works in a library or who has fond memories of the library, to hear that the library has now become a dangerous place for children, it's just counter to any kind of reality that any of us understand. And it's not just an attack on the library, but it undermines trust in that institution, trust in the librarian. It sows fear and anxiety among people in the community. When you tell people that the library is not a safe place for kids, that has a real impact on a community. And it's librarians that are being targeted here. And so I think that's important for people to understand that when, there's this case in Alabama right now of a librarian who refused to remove books about LGBTQ plus experience from his library at the direction of his politicized board. And he was then fired, and his staff has faced employment discrimination. And the impact of that is that you don't have a library anymore. And so all of the work that libraries do that I think a lot of people don't see because maybe they have the means to not rely on the library for access to information and broadband internet and community and space to be with each other and to be by themselves, right? Like who don't need the library miss sometimes the impact that those attacks have on the library. It just turns the library into a tool of ongoing division in our communities. It's really dangerous, sad, and scary.
Which, of course, means there are some libraries, out of fear of attack, which do respond to book challenges and remove titles from their collection. But even then, there is a danger this can pose for librarians whose instinct is to provide information and resources, and they are forced to act against that instinct.
I've learned this concept recently of moral injury, moral harm, when one has to, due to constraints outside of one's control, violate the values that we hold most dear. And I think there are a lot of librarians across the country right now facing exactly that. I can't pretend to speak to how they navigate that situation. We have librarians, I am sure, engaging in resistance in ways large and small to ensure that the people in our communities have access to the stories they need. I come back again and again to this report from the Human Rights Campaign and the American Association of School Librarians, which is a division of ALA. And they asked gender expansive and trans youth if they felt safe at school. And a majority reported feeling unsafe at school on any given day, and 90% reported feeling safe in the school library. So when you compare that number to suicide rates among trans youth, if you look at states where organized challenges go alongside efforts to limit access to gender-affirming healthcare for youth, like, we're talking about a life and death situation. And to put a librarian in the position where she has to decide whether to risk her livelihood, her place in the community, her potentially even her safety. There are cases of librarians being followed home from work by heavily armed people. Like, choosing between taking those kinds of personal risks and ensuring that access to stories that can be life-saving for people. And, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask of an individual librarian, which is why we need a strong American Library Association right now, so that people know they're not alone, so that they know that they have the support of the national body. And we need people in communities who care about people reading books, you know, people, youth surviving. We need those people to see that the fight right now is in the library, and that we need to be standing up for libraries whenever we can.
And as Emily Drabinski makes clear, there are librarians fighting back. Some are taking legal action. Some are even running for office. And many are simply just doing their jobs.
You know, I want to say also that librarians, regardless of the sort of political atmosphere, we continue to fulfill our core mission to our community. So as much as I talk to librarians and they talk to me about the fear that they are feeling and the anxiety and the concern of being, you know, becoming targets for a sort of organized pressure campaigns in their communities, they all also tell me amazing, wonderful, beautiful stories about what happens in their libraries. And so I think it's important to remember that we are not passive recipients of this kind of hate, but in fact are actively working, regardless of what's happening around us, to meet the needs of people in our communities. But it is of great concern. They want to know why this is happening. They want to know how we can stop it, what role we can play in battling back against these efforts, not only to eliminate books, but in many cases, it feels almost like an attempt to eliminate the library altogether. So, librarians are feeling like they need people to understand what's happening because, you know, the vast majority of people support their libraries and support librarians. And so we know that we can win when everybody stands together on behalf of the free access to information and the right to read for everyone. So we just need people to be standing with us in this moment.
As for how to do that, exactly how to support libraries, Emily Durbinsky does have some very concrete suggestions.
So I want to say the first thing you can do is to support your public library. That means, at the very least, if you don't have a library card, don't go and get one. If you have a friend or a family member who doesn't have a library card, make sure they get one. Go to your library, use the take advantage of the programs and services, check out a book. If we look at the public institutions that have survived these kinds of political fights, they're the ones that everybody uses, right? So we need everybody to use the library.
In addition to that, and to better empower individuals to fight censorship in their communities and preserve our right to choose what to read, the ALA created in 2022 the Unite Against Book Bans campaign as a way to organize on the issue and make sure that people had access to resources they need to take action.
The Unite Against Book Bans campaign was launched in direct response to the organized censorship attacks we're facing right now. UABB brings together institutional partners who care about what we care about, as well as individuals. The website offers lots and lots of resources for organizing your home community, everything from how to write a letter to the editor to how to run for your library board. We need people who care about libraries to be in charge of libraries. That's super important, making sure that the board is stacked with people who want the library to continue. But we also use the platform to mobilize people when we hear of particular intellectual freedom challenges that are happening across the country. And one case in New Jersey, UABB, along with other groups, was able to work our list, you know, in a very traditional movement way and pull out 400 people to a board meeting to support a librarian who is facing an attempt to challenge the books in her high school collection. So UABB is a big umbrella. We need everybody under it who cares about libraries and cares about the right to read.
That was Emily Durbinsky, president of the American Library Association. To learn more about the American Library Association's work on the issue of book banning and to join their effort to unite against book bans, visit ALA.org. That's ALA.org. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin.
We close the show today with a jazz birthday. Yesterday, April 14th, marked what would have been the 99th birthday of saxophonist and band leader, the Boss, Gene Emmons. The son of a pianist, Gene began playing at an early age and began touring in late high school. He played with Miles, Coltrane, and notably Sonny Stitt, among many, many others. He overcame brushes with the law to pursue a prolific career, recording dozens of records as bandleader and co-leader before dying at the young age of 49. Gene was born and died in Chicago, and is buried in the city's Lincoln Cemetery in Blue Island. From his final record, here's the title track, Goodbye. Happy birthday, and long live Gene Ammons. And that's our show for today. Rest in peace and power, Askia Muhammad. Thanks to our engineers. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
And I'm Sue Goodwin. Thank you for listening and supporting Jazz and Justice Radio in the nation's capital.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams, recently appointed interim general manager. I want to thank each and every one of you who supported WPFW during our recent relocation drive. You are the fuel that keeps us going. We appreciate your generosity and the collaboration of building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Please know we all love you madly.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
ADASI, the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, will host a free D.C. Emancipation Day program entitled Black Liberation Struggles in Global Africa. Then and now, on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Enlightened Inc., 1205 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast, the program will commemorate the enslaved ancestors who crossed over the Old Navy Yard Bridge, the precursor to the 11th Street Bridge in Southeast, from enslavement in Maryland to freedom in the District of Columbia after the abolition of slavery in D.C. on April 16, 1862. It will feature esteemed historian C.R. Gibbs and many others. For information, please call 202-505-2896 or visit adasiancestors.org. That's A-D-A-C-I ancestors.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Sunday's a special on 89.3 FM. Join host Miyuki Williams on WPFW and treat yourself to a Sunday kind of love. From noon until 2 p.m. each and every week on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
Sego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Kane.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for Jazz and Justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to WPFW.com. lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice.